Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You done with your Oreo?
Yeah, done with my Oreo.
Okay, good. Do you really know what happened? The brother did.
The brother, that's what I thought too.
I mean, that seems like kind of obvious.
Hey, do you want to talk about death?
Yeah. I mean, that's
a mystery, murdery thingy.
Okay, are you ready?
Yes. Are you ready?
Yeah, dude, I've been ready.
I have done been ready. I just got ready.
Okay, let's...
I think we've gotten into our routine,
sit.
You know. We do our write-up and then
relax.
We go...
Ooh, okay, are that
you going to fall asleep
what?
During this
episode? Yep.
This is going to be the nap
right
episode.
Smack in the middle of the episode.
Welcome to the very exciting mystery murdery thingy where we fucking fall asleep.
My name is Chloe.
My name is... Mario.
Oh, that was frustrating. Okay, Mario, are you doing a mystery, a
murdery,
or a
it'd be murdery this week.
It'd be murdery.
Yes.
Mine's not murdery. Mine's a straight up mystery.
Why do we tend to do like a mix, but we never talk about it.
What do you mean?
Like, usually you'll do something murdery and I won't, or I'll do something murdery and you won't.
Yeah.
But it's not like we coordinate.
Because
we're not that coordinated. We just, like, it happens to be that
way.
Yeah,
I don't really like you that much, so.
You're like, okay, you know, it's like, whatever.
Yeah, you're just kind of here, you know. You're only here because I can only afford $450 for rent. So
right.
It's the full
right.
$900, you know?
Like, it I does, just, you know, makes it much more affordable.
Yeah, true, I mean, true, that's true. The only reason you're here.
Okay.
To be honest. I'm just kidding.
Right. Couples counseling on the air. Anyway, should we jump into it?
Yeah.
Am I gonna
go
first? Or?
It sounds like you want to go first.
I mean, if you were just gonna jump into it,
I had no preference. So why don't you go ahead?
Great.
Go ahead.
So
pal.
I'm gonna do something.
Here for you.
Thank you so much. Love you. Something murdery, like I said, and specifically, I'm gonna be covering just kind of briefly the murder that's come to be known as the White Mischief Murder.
I'm
that's
sorry.
What it's called.
I just nothing.
No, what?
I just thought of like
apparently there's also like a vodka called White Mischief, so
oh nice.
Or something like that.
I thought of just like white people and like
yep.
It's, I don't know why I immediately thought of white people.
Well, it's about white people. That's specifically why it's called the White Mischief Murder.
Isn't everything about white people today, Mario?
Pretty much. Also in 1941 when this happened.
Especially in 1941, don't
also,
you know?
Also in Kenya,
oh,
where
Jesus.
These white people were being fucking terrible. So let's get into it. So the reason this kind of came to my attention was because some more recent news reports from like 2007... claimed that this murder has been solved, but we'll kind of see that there's still like some mystery and a lot of intrigue to this case. There's a reason to talk about it.
Cool.
It's like Agatha Christie, but real life. If you ever like watch or read Agatha Christie. So anyway, picture it: Kenya, early on the morning of January 24th of 1941.
Most Americans can't picture Kenya. We're two.
It's out. In the dark, in this deserted crossroads, on this sort of intersection of two roads between Nairobi and Ngong, and the Right Honorable Jocelyn Hay, 22nd Earl of Errol, Baron of Kilmarnock, and High Constable of Scotland,
wow,
all of those things, was on his way home from dropping off the married woman that he'd just had sex with.
Nice.
Yes.
I mean, no, bad.
Yes, so such was life for the, yes, white and mainly British aristocrats, some might say scum, yeah, whatever, living very high off the hog in the so-called Happy Valley. They were called the Happy Valley Set. So for
sounds
decades,
like a cult.
So it sort of was. They had been, you know, a group of rich and very rowdy hedonists, the non-pariah of hedonists. And of course, they'd been oppressing the locals, you know, at de rigueur for Dutch or English or whomever who's making, you know, been worming their way into power in Africa for, you know, 100 years at that point. Mm-hmm. As per usual as well, Lord Errol, the victim, typically had at least one mistress, if not more, in addition to his wife, although he was a widower at this point. Usually the mistress was someone else's wife, by the way. Reportedly, Lord Errol's personal motto, unofficial, was, quote, to hell with husbands, close quote. Okay. So just to not to put a too fine a point on it. But yeah, he's going to sleep with your wife. That's essentially, that's what it comes down to. And most recently, before his untimely death, timely, some might say, I guess.
Mario.
No, you'll see. You'll agree with me by the end. Don't worry. He was not a good person. Don't worry. This is like a victim. Yes, everyone's a person. No one deserves to die, but he wasn't a very good person. So, most recently, Lord Errol's eye had been quite taken by a new addition to the Happy Valley set. The young, I think she was 26, 28, something like that, and newly married Lady Diana Broughton. And she had just married the 30 years older Sir Jock Delves Broughton.
Oh.
And moved to Happy Valley in Kenya soon thereafter. And she and Lord Errol very quickly struck up a romance under the not very attentive nose of Diana's husband, Sir Broughton. Well, if you've ever heard the word cuckold, it's a bit of a impolite term, but it does apply in this instance quite nicely. Not long after this romance started going, reportedly, Diana told Sir Broughton that it was over, that she would invoke this very strange clause in their prenuptial agreement that allowed her to divorce Sir Broughton and still receive 7 years of alimony if she fell in love with a younger man and decided to leave him of her own volition. It's kind of strange, right? But it was there, written down in a contract they both signed, so okay. Whatever. And the very dashing, and yes, younger than Sir Broughton, with Lord Errol was the man, you know, that she decided to leave him for. Not very long after she had married Sir Broughton. She also had a bunch of husbands in her life. She was married like 4 or 5 times.
Sir Broughton was the one who's 30 years older than her?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. He is the cuckolded husband, much older, who's there sort of figuring this out, right? That this is going on. Over the course of the days and weeks, right? So Sir Broughton seemed to, you know, when he did kind of figure things out, right, take his stunning new wife's change of heart, right, toward Lord Errol quite in stride, in good humor, it seemed. He even had dinner with her, Lord Errol, and another friend of theirs, I believe, at the Mutaiga Club in Nairobi on the night of January 23rd, right, the night before, of course, Lord Errol's friend dead, and even toasted the new couple with champagne and said, you know, I bless your union.
Wow,
it's okay with me.
Snarky piece of shit.
it's weird, right? But it's not that out of the norm for the Happy Valley set. Like,
okay.
People sleeping with each other's wives, polyamory was like almost required there, right? That's kind of like how it went. Yeah, exactly. You're making a face. Not in a good way. I shouldn't say polyamory because it was, I'm sure.
I was like, I feel like polyamory is consensual.
Right. This
and
was.
We don't know how much of this was consensual.
Exactly,
we can't say.
Exactly. No, I'm sure it was more, exploitative in a lot of instances, ooh, you know, one way or the other. So like I said, the next day, January 24th, Lord Errol is found dead. His body stuffed under the steering wheel of his car, actually. On that lonely crossroads between Nairobi and Ngong, Kenya, Lord Errol had been shot in the back of the head, right behind his ear.
Suicide.
Right, of course. No. Police had also found some inexplicable sort of white scuff marks on the floor on the back of the car. They never figured out what it was, but it may have been figured out later on. Anyway, suspicion quickly fell on Sir Broughton, of course, right? Once they figured out, okay, he had been sleeping with this guy's wife. He just found out, okay, yeah, let's get pick him up. But let's just briefly, very, very briefly cover some other suspects that came up, sort of at least in rumor and stuff. So for a time, Lady Diana Broughton herself, the wife, you know, was thought to may have done it. Not totally clear why she would have, but that was something that came up. Another member of the Happy Valley set, you know, was a suspect. Just anyone else who may have been pissed off at Lord Errol, because again, he was carousing with everyone. He was not well liked amongst a lot of people, so he had a lot of enemies. You know, a lot of people had a motive for killing him. Or perhaps even someone from the British Secret Service, and this is where you're going to—he's not a good person. Angered by Lord Errol, the victim's Nazi sympathies.
Ah,
yep,
shit.
He was a Nazi sympathizer.
No.
Yep, he was there with Rudolf Hess, and yeah, he would have, if he had had his way, Britain probably would have been on the other side. Let's say that.
I thought he was going to be like a little annoying rich kid, not like a fucking Nazi sympathizer.
He's a full-on Nazi sympathizer, reportedly.
That makes my stomach hurt.
I know, right? So, yeah. But all those other, you know, possible perpetrators were sort of dismissed fairly quickly. And the trial of Sir Broughton commenced pretty soon thereafter. So, strangely, though, Lady Broughton, right, Diana, the mm-hmm, lover of the
yes,
victim, the
yes.
wife of the accused, didn't testify. She just wasn't there during the trial.
Was she called
no,
to testify?
No, was never called to testify.
Okay, so what?
Yeah, well, there were some irregularities. So the trial created a huge sensation, especially back in England, where the populace was suffering under the bombing of the Nazi Luftwaffe, right, the bombing of London and so forth, and didn't appreciate quite, you know, hearing about the lascivious and wasteful and, like, this all this crazy shit going on down in Africa that these British royals are doing, right? I'm here, like, getting fucking bombed and paying $20 for a loaf of bread, whereas, you know, this guy's living it up in Kenya.
Yeah, what the hell?
What's going on? And sleeping with each other's wives and the whole deal, right? Likewise, they were, a lot of people, you know, the populace was pretty outraged when Sir Broughton was acquitted pretty quickly for lack of evidence.
I mean, yeah.
There was a perception that a miscarriage of justice had probably occurred, and that sort of seems to have been the case, as we'll see. So, first of all, Sir Broughton's barber, like his personal barber, is like a friend of his, right?
Gossip.
Was the foreman of the jury. And I think another person also was like a friend of his. So that's like very, very strange, right? Not great. And
I mean, but is it different in the Kenyan, like, system? Or?
Well, they would have been under the British system.
Oh, okay.
Right. There was no Kenyan system that they would have ever been subject to, right?
Okay.
It was all just British. And no, that was not standard practice for... most of our practice in terms of law comes from British practice. So, like, it's no, that should not have happened. But I should say in the accused's defense, you know, to sort of exonerate Sir Broughton possibly, right, was that he did have a pronounced limp that seemed to preclude him being able to shoot Lord Errol and then get without a car, because there were no car tracks found around, right? From there, from the crime scene to a house where Sir Broughton was seen checking on a drunk friend that they had mm-hmm. dinner with the night before, right, who was known to drink way too much. And I think he was there like 30 minutes or something after the crime occurred. So they were like, well, he couldn't have done it and gotten there. So then it couldn't possibly be him, right? However, a year after Sir Broughton was acquitted and released, he killed himself in the Adelphi Hotel in Liverpool from a lethal dose of morphine, which obviously would seem to suggest consciousness of guilt.
Or just...
I mean, at that point, he had lost
being
his
in a murder
wife
trial.
And been accused. I mean, sure, it could be. However, what kind of further substantiates that it probably was him was Ooh. That there was reportedly several interviewed tapes produced in the late 80s or at least partly then that but not revealed until 2007 where it was revealed according to those people, definitively that Sir Broughton was the murderer and that he did kill Lord Errol on that January back in 1941. Now, I should say there were no eyewitnesses to the murder. No one's claiming to have seen it, per se. And there was no physical evidence ever found to link Sir Broughton to the murder itself. But, like I said, people on that those series of tapes described by the writer Christina Nichols in a book around that time, around 2007, claimed to have been told what really happened on that night back
by
in 1941. I'll kind of get into it. It's essentially some neighbors, right? So originally, I should say these tapes from 1987 were passed by another author, Mary Edwards, who actually took the tapes, but they weren't revealed later because the people on the tapes didn't want them to be until they were long dead. Because they were accusing these like high ranking people of murder, right? So the people on the tape, which it was essentially like the children of some of the neighbors who were around at the time, claimed to know that while Lord Errol had dropped off Diana, Sir Broughton, right, the accused murderer, had snuck into the back of the car, unbeknownst to Lord Errol. So they're kissing goodnight, right, and Sir Broughton sneaking through the dark.
What?
Opening up the back door, getting in, slowly, carefully closing it, and hunching down and waiting for Lord Errol to get to that crossroads out in the middle of nowhere so you could shoot him in the head.
I'm afraid that's going to happen to me.
I check the back of my car pretty much every time I get in it because I've seen that in way too many movies and stuff. Right? Like we were talking the other day, like, I don't trust humans.
Oh, yeah.
So after, you know, allegedly Sir Broughton had killed Lord Errol out at that crossroads, leaving those white scuff marks with his white plimsoll shoes, apparently this particular type of shoe that would have left that, he was picked up by Dr. Ethan Phillip.
Okay.
To whom Sir Broughton had given a large sum of money to pick him up a little bit of a ways away from here. And apparently he, according to these tapes, had planned the whole thing very carefully. Had allowed his wife to go out on this date with Lord Errol, right? Told her, okay, be back by this certain time so he could be waiting up, get in the car, and then told this other guy to meet him, you know, a little bit down the road, a little bit later, and then he could be seen at this house soon thereafter to give him an alibi. So it was all, like, very carefully planned, you know, premeditated, one might say. Although, of course, like I said, he was eventually acquitted. And it wasn't ever clear, really, how much Dr. Phillip knew, the guy who drove him, but, I mean, how could you not have figured that out afterwards, at least, right? It's like, he knew, you know, but anyway. The tapes give some more tantalizing, if unprovable, details. And specifically, particularly, these come for Juanita Carberry, who was the 15-year-old, at that time, daughter of the Broughtons' neighbor, who had supposedly visited Sir Broughton's house the day of the murder on January 24th, and encountered a, quote, tense, unquote, atmosphere and Lady Broughton crying uncontrollably. And I just want to read kind of an extended quote from The Telegraph, including that author Christina Nichols describing what happened next. Quote, a servant came in to say there was a fire in the garden on the manure heap. Juanita saw clothes burning and a pair of good white plimsolls smoldering on top, says Nichols. Shocked at the waste, Juanita suggested they be given to an African servant, but Sir Broughton, dismissed the idea. It was the white rubber soles of the plimsolls that had made the mysterious marks inside the car. Nichols has spoken extensively to Juanita, who is now in her 80s and lives in a flat in Chelsea. She has said that 2 days later, Delves Broughton told her not to be surprised if the police turned up to arrest him for the murder of Errol. Juanita was very taken aback and said, "Oh no, you couldn't have done that," says Nichols. Quote, Delves Broughton's response was a deadpan. But I did.
What?
And I have just dropped the gun over the bridge into the river at Theca. Close quote.
Did they buy the gun?
No. And, well, someone did, yes. Several people. But it kind of went through a bit of a journey. So, according to the tapes, right, the gun was dropped into the river, right, before Lord Errol had apparently confessed to this girl. For some reason. And
ego.
Then I think a different person or him, I can't remember exactly. I didn't write the whole timeline down. But someone got nervous about this, right? And was like, oh, shit, they're going to find it, right? If you just throw it in the river. So they had a servant go and fish it out of the river, and then they took it to this town, like, far away from there, and hid it in a ceiling. And then later, when they were doing, like, repairs on that room or something, a worker found it and brought it to the people who owned the hotel. And then I think it was taken by Sir Broughton out on a, like, a deep-sea diving boat out to very deep ocean and dropped in the ocean where it, you know, ostensibly still is today. Yeah, exactly.
What?
But it was never recovered by police.
This is all hearsay? It's just what people are saying?
This is all pure hearsay. Yes, it's good to underline that this is sort of the definition of hearsay, right? This person told me that someone told them.
Yeah.
So it's, this is not evidence. And this is why it's still a mystery, right? And this is why, essentially, I found that it had enough mystery for us to talk about it. But yeah, but lots, mainly because it's still, it's very intriguing.
There's lots of hearsay.
So anyway, that's pretty much it. But yeah, like I said, a little bit of mystery still surrounds it. And that's the White Mischief murder. Although there's another murder also called the White Mischief murder that happened later that was sort of compared to this one. But anyway, that one's not a mystery, I don't think. So my sources are the Daily Mail, an unsigned article, Judith Woods, The Telegraph, Michelle Fall at LA Times, and of course Wikipedia, the Jocelyn Hay 22nd Earl of Errol page, the Jock Delves Broughton page, and the Happy Valley Set page. And just because I haven't done it in a long time, I think, I just wanted to shout out a particular place that's been listening to us, because, of course, I look at this obsessively.
I do not. It freaks me out.
Woolloomooloo, Australia. That we've got at least one consistent listener I've been seeing from there, and I just wanted to say that name because it's funny, and I like saying it. Woolloomooloo. So,
Mario, when are you going to take me to Kenya?
Right.
When are you going to take me to Australia?
When are you going to take me to Australia?
Okay, let me get in the mode here in the podcasting.
Okay.
Damn it.
Are you there yet?
Yes.
Good.
So, I am doing, it's called, okay, so this is a mysterious extortion case, which you wouldn't think would be mysterious, but it is.
Interesting. I think that might be a new kind of mystery from us.
When you don't know who's doing the extorting.
Yeah.
And people don't know.
We've never talked about anything like that before.
Yeah, this is crazy. So this is the Glico Morinaga case, officially named Metropolitan Designated Case 114, the story of kidnapping, extortion, and attempted murder. So the entire ordeal went on for about 17 months, and the man or people, we don't know. Total mystery. It starts with a kidnapping. So this series of attacks against two Japanese candy companies began with the kidnapping of Katsuhisa Izaki, the president of a multi-million dollar confectionery company called Glico. So Glico is based in Osaka, Japan. They sell like candies, ice cream, puddings. They sell like even hamburger meat, stuff like that. I don't know. On March 18th of 1984, two men broke into Izaki's home. Before taking him, the men first broke into his mother's home next door, tied her up, and took the keys. And that's how they got into Izaki's home. They cut the phone lines. They tied up his wife and daughter before storming into the bathroom and abducting him. The assailants then took him to an abandoned warehouse. The next day, the kidnappers called the director of Glico, and they put out a ransom demand of 1 billion yen, which is about $4.2 million in dollars.
In U.S. dollars?
Yes.
There are Canadian dollars and Australian dollars.
In U.S. dollars. And 100 kilos of gold bullion. How do you say it?
Bullion, I think.
Bullion?
I don't know why you said it kind of funny at first.
I don't know.
You say it? Bullion.
Bullion for his safe return. So, but A few days later, Katsuhisa Ezaki managed to escape from the warehouse totally unharmed, and he got the hell out of there.
Good for him.
Yes. The terror continued even after he escaped. Like, everybody, there weren't any leads. Everybody thought it was going to be over. It wasn't. In April, the next month, 10 vehicles sitting parked outside the Glico headquarters were torched, and all the cars burst into flames, and the surrounding area burst into flames, and it was deliberate act of arson, and they don't know who did it. In mid-May, Glico receives a taunting letter in the mail from the perpetrators, who signed the letter as the monster with 21 faces. It's actually named after the villain of Edogawa Rampo's detective novels. And it also translates to the mystery man with 21 faces and the phantom of 21 faces. And claimed that they had laced numerous packages of Glico candies with cyanide. And then Glico had to pull the candy from the shelves. They lost tons of money, and they had to cut over 400 employees. Their stock plummeted, and the candies were tested for cyanide, but nothing was ever found. And like I said, the sales plummeted. They lost like $130 million and eventually had to lay off a total of 1,000 employees.
What year did you say this was?
1984.
So this was right, I can't remember, it was right around the same time as the Tylenol murders in Chicago, and there were some copycats of that where people did the same thing. They claimed that they had poisoned or tainted these things, but they hadn't.
Yeah.
So it's just weird that was happening, like, on both sides of the globe around that same time.
Humans.
Yeah.
The Osaka police started receiving taunting letters from the monster. There were around 200 different officers that were investigating the case, like, total, and they virtually had nothing. And I actually read a New York Times article. I read a lot of archived New York Times articles.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them talked about, like, the reputation of police in Japan at the time, and how, like, they weren't doing very well. And, like, a couple months before, one police officer confessed to shooting, like, straight up murdering another one, and, like, stuff like that. Yeah. So in these letters, they would be demanding huge amounts of cash, but they would never show up to collect it. No one was ever captured, though, and there wasn't really any proof that any money was ever actually accepted in the first place, that money actually changed hands. So it's more of a taunt. And then, like, they pretend like they're going to take action, but nothing happens. And like I said, the reputation of the police at this time in Japan wasn't very good. So the letters were taunting. They were saying things like, quote, poor, stupid cops, end quote. The newspaper Yomiuri said in an editorial, quote, we do not recall a case in which criminals have made such fools of the police, end quote. Yeah. Others thought differently, like Hiroshi Shinohara, a deputy director of the Criminal Investigation Bureau. He said, quote, I don't believe this has damaged public trust in the police, and our morale has not been affected, end quote. In June of 1984, the monster wrote more letters to newspaper offices, saying that they had, quote, become bored with the affair, end quote, and they were moving on. They claimed that they, like, destroyed the other cyanide-laced candies that they had. It was a really weird letter. And so, like, Wikipedia's page was there, but it had a lot of sources that weren't cited. Mm-hmm. And so I never really quoted any of the full letters, except for one from Atlas Obscura.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only one I actually like, and I'll read it later. But they were weird and, like, very braggy, and said, one of our consultants, one of our team members, one of our people is like a 4-year-old and we can't have him crying every time he's like eating candy or something stupid like that. It was weird. So come on, pal. I need a new computer. yeah. And there was this thing, though, and like I said, this was only on Wikipedia, and then it was on a different webpage that said Wikipedia was their source, about an identified suspect that they called, quote, the Fox-Eyed Man. So the monster claimed to end all this nonsense for 50 million yen. The plan was to have an employee, and this was kind of confusing between what was wrote on Wikipedia and what was wrote on the other website, but basically the plan was to have an employee throw the money into a moving train when like a white flag was displayed. However, when an investigator who was like gonna go do it, disguised as an employee, when he was on a train heading to the drop-off point, he noticed a suspicious man who was observing him and following him. He was described, quote, as a large, well-built man wearing sunglasses, his hair cut short and permed, with eyes like those of a fox, end quote. But like I said, this was only found on Wikipedia, and a lot of citations didn't have any sources. But it was kind of interesting, and they talked about that like money drop. And it was, like, slightly mentioned in some other articles, but it wasn't, there wasn't anything about, like, a fox-eyed man or anything like that. And it was also kind of confusing because I couldn't tell if the employee was supposed to be, like, waiting for the train somewhere and tossing it in, or if he was supposed to be on the train, tossing it out, and then the person on the train was looking at him or something like that. And I was like, that doesn't make sense because who's he tossing it out to? But when it was really confusing, yes.
Does it also not make sense that you would see the eyes of someone who's wearing sunglasses?
I know, right?
He said he's wearing sunglasses and he's fox-eyed. Did he, like, take off his sunglasses and look at him with his fox eyes? Like,
I don't know, man.
That's strange.
It was...
This is a very strange story.
That part was definitely the strangest.
What actually is going on? That's, like, the mystery here. Like, what the fuck is
actually
going on?
No one knows who these people are or
why. What their intention was.
Exactly.
Were they serious? Were they not serious? Did they ever intend to hurt anyone?
Well, a few months later, in September of 1984, the monster called up Morinaga, another popular candy company in Japan, and demanded 100 million yen, about $400,000. Morinaga didn't comply. They ignored it. And then several weeks later in October, Morinaga as well as hundreds of other Japanese newspapers received a threat in the form of a letter. And this is the one I wrote, quote, or not me wrote, the one I found that I liked the best to, never mind, quote,
we don't claim to have written things from other sources. So, like, okay.
Quote, to moms throughout Japan, in autumn when appetites are strong, sweets are really delicious. When you think sweets, no matter what you say, it's Morinaga. We've added some special flavor. The flavor of potassium cyanide is a little bitter. It won't cause tooth decay, so buy the sweets for your kids. We've attached a notice on these bitter sweets that they contain poison. We've put 20 boxes in stores from Hakata to Tokyo. So they had to take all their boxes out. Eventually, 10 boxes of sweets from store shelves in Osaka, Kyoto, and Nagoya were removed, and all of them had typewritten labels that read, quote, danger, contains poison, you'll die if you eat this, the mysterious man, the 21 faces, end quote. And 6 of them reportedly did contain potassium cyanide, and one was a sufficient dosage to be lethal.
Hmm.
So when you said, like, I wonder if they actually were planning to hurt people, maybe they were.
Except for the big label, right?
And the arson.
Oh, that's true. The arson was destruction of property, if nothing else.
And the kidnapping. I wonder what they're planning to do.
But they didn't, it didn't said, and I don't know if it got into this in your sources, but it didn't sound like they beat them up. or
no?
And he got away,
but he was armed, or not him. The assailants attackers. Were armed. Yeah.
Okay. So they were serious, semi-serious at least.
I mean, it was very well planned. They tied up the mom next door, cut the phone lines, tied up the whole family before even going for him.
You're right. It's not just some, like, someone doing it for a goof or something. Like,
right.
Clearly, there's some organization behind this.
But then some of it is like, what?
Yeah. I don't know.
Investigators started staking out grocery stores and putting surveillance everywhere. It was later reported that a man wearing a baseball cap was caught shelving packs of Glico candy, and he had been caught on security camera, and they confirmed that he was suspicious looking and that he also wasn't affiliated with the store.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really, like, that's really it. I mean, they identified what kind of typewriter was being used to write the letters, but really nothing else. They had no names. So audio from the blackmailing telephone call to Morinaga was eventually released, and on it were the voices of a woman and child demanding money, and investigators even set up, like, a hotline, like, special phone line, so that people could call in, listen to it, and, like, give tips and, like, see if they recognized it. Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Wow.
The monster continued to taunt other candy companies, demanding more money here, demanding more money there. But there were no other, like, serious threats or any more action that was taken. And the police still, at this point, didn't have any suspects. There was a sketch of the man in the surveillance video, was released in January of 1985. But again, there were no serious leads or tips. And so... no one died directly as a result from the Monster with 21 Faces crimes, right? It could have been something very deadly. However, indirectly was the death of Shoji Yamamoto, and he was the head of the Shiga Prefecture Police. And he had a lot of pressure on his shoulders. He blamed himself for the entire ordeal. The media was hounding them and all the investigators for some kind of answer. They wanted, you know, a suspect in handcuffs now. And he eventually ended up committing suicide by dousing himself with kerosene and lighting himself on fire.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Absolutely tragic.
Wow.
5 days later, the monster sent out his last letter, making light of Yamamoto's death, among other things. And he said that, like, we didn't even have any, like, people over in Shiga. Like, why did blah, blah, blah? It was terrible. And they officially, I mean, yeah, they were saying that they were, like, done taunting food making companies because, quote, we are bad guys. That means we've got more to do than, we've got more to do other than bullying companies. It's fun to lead a bad man's life, end quote.
Hmm.
So, some theories. And like I said, we still don't know who the monster with 21 faces is. Is it one person, a group? And then especially, I mean, for me, it's like, what was the motive here?
Right.
Right?
That's the big mystery to me, too.
Yeah. Some thought it was people from the Yakuza mob.
Well, that's what I was thinking, yeah.
Which, for those who don't know, is one of the largest crime syndicates in the world. I mean, at the time, they had over 100,000 people working, you know, working, quote-unquote, employed for them in one way or another. They had a huge hand in the pornography industry in Japan. They got money from bribes, extortion, sex trafficking, drugs, all of it. Or it could have been something political, like some extreme white right-wing or left-wing person trying to act out. It could have been disgruntled employees. There was a merger not too long before all of this started between two Glico subsidiaries, and a lot of people lost their jobs. And then it could have been someone with a personal vendetta against Katsuhisa Ezaki. You know, is very multi-millionaire of this huge company, very public figure, maybe had some enemies. In total, the police investigated 125,000 people and followed up on 28,300 public tips. Nothing.
Wow.
Yeah, they did. They looked at alibis and nothing. And the monster with 21 faces was kind of disappeared. Never heard from again. In June of 1995, the statute of limitations ran out. It ran out on the assault and kidnapping of Izaki. So that was never, they never found out who did that. And the statute of limitations for attempted murder for like the food products, that ran out in February of 2000. So, I don't know. It's what, 19 years, 20 years? Where's our confession? Where's our deathbed confession?
It reminds me of the Max Headroom mystery in that way, because it's like, well, why hasn't someone just come forward by now? Like,
right.
It's you know, relatively not that big a deal. And, like, it's, everyone wants to know. Just tell us. I don't know.
So, my sources was an article from the Japan Times written in 1999. And, like, I did get a little bit of Wikipedia, but like I usually get from Wikipedia, Wikipedia knows how to organize things well. And right. So I was like, because sometimes with mysteries, I'm like, where do we even start with this? You know, right. And Wikipedia always has a good structure. So mm-hmm. I usually copy structure from Wikipedia. historicmysteries.com article by Doug McGowan. Atlas Obscura article by Kara Giamio. And then three different New York Times articles, all by Clyde Haberman. The first one titled The... What?
Just Clyde Haberman's
the
father of current writer Maggie Haberman, who's like one of the big political writers in the New York Times right now.
Wow. So, anyway. Yeah, these were all in the late 90s, mid to late 90s.
Sure.
The title's The Great Candy Caper Leaves All Japan a-Twitter. Police in Japan, badges have lost their sparkle, and poison candy found on Japanese store shelves. So, I felt the police in Japan badges have lost their sparkle one was super interesting, because that one was about, like, how Japan police were seen at the time, and how the monster with 21 faces, like, affected that, and all that kind of good stuff. So, yeah.
Interesting. Cool.
That's what I've got.
You got some weird shit
in the news. Weird shit in the news.
In the news.
I have, I do. It's not weird. It's interesting. And it's interesting.
and it's also interesting. Interesting.
So this is from HuffPost. And it's about, like, your phone charger and some safety risks.
Okay.
So, the title of the article is Woman Suffers Severe Burns After Phone Charger Zaps Her Necklace. And I was like, how, what, who, what, how? So this 19-year-old woman in Michigan. So, okay. Yeah. So, the incident was detailed in a case report in the Annals of Emergency Medicine. And that whole thing talks about risk to children and safety concerns about charging products. And it was published in July 17th, and she was taken to the, like, emergency room with a severe burn around her neck. Quote, she was, and I was like, how, what happened? So here's what the report said. It said, quote, she was lying in bed wearing a chain necklace and the charger underneath her pillow and then plugged into an electrical outlet when she felt a sudden burning sensation and severe pain around her neck. She likely sustained an electrical injury from the charger as it came in contact with her necklace, causing a burn. She was released the same day after treatment and was given antibiotics, and that's about it. But they talked about, like, generic electronic chargers and how, like, you know, it could be risky.
Right.
And I was like,
yeah.
Okay. Like, do we take it seriously? I guess we do. I feel like we would. Yeah. I mean, better safe than sorry, right?
Sure. I don't want
to. But it's just an unusual situation. Like, I would never have thought of that happening to someone.
Yeah, but apparently it's possible. Well, mine is a little bit funnier than that. I'm going to tell you about.
Mine wasn't funny at all. It was just interesting.
That's true. mine's from Vice, and it's by Jaleesa Castradale.
Thank you, Jaleesa.
We don't know her. And if that's a woman, I think so.
Like the name.
Anyway, it's a good name. Titled Highly Relatable Raccoons Busted for Being Day Drunk in Residential Neighborhood.
Nice. You mean Normal, Illinois on Saturday October?
This was actually in Canada, but sure.
You're not talking about homecoming, no?
not per se. So, yes, apparently this is a thing that happens, especially in this one area. I guess I can't find where it actually is, but anyway. There's this, like, this neighborhood where people kept seeing these stumbling around raccoons, sort of looking very intoxicated, and apparently they were. They had been eating crab apples. So if you don't know, fruit, if you just leave it out, right, becomes alcohol. Like, that's fermentation, right? So there are lots of animals who actually get drunk doing this just naturally. It's wonderful and a beauty of nature, right? these fucking drunk as shit raccoons stumbling around your yard. It's the wonders of nature. Truly. That's all I have to say about that.
That's all I have to say about that. And that's comments.
All I have to say about that.
No. Anyway.
Forrest Gump? No. Didn't get it.
Is that from Forrest Gump?
It is.
I haven't seen Forrest Gump in a while.
Oh.
Good long movie.
Very long. Very long movie.
It's a good
movie.
Good talk. Anywho.
Anyway, thanks for listening, y'all.
Yes, thank you so much.
And
don't forget to tell your friends.
Tell all the people that you know in Woolloomooloo.
Follow us on... I mean, yeah. Follow us on all the social medias, yes. Facebook, Twitter.
MarioTech30 if you want to get some political opinions on articles that I read.
If you want to have a timeline full of links to articles...
Do you like the New York Times?
Do you like the Washington Post?
Do you like NPR? You might like
I quite enjoy NPR.
NPR is great. As are those other publications. Anyway. That's it, I think.
That's it.
Okay.
Peace out, Girl Scout. Until next Wednesday.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.